Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs where families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are here on top of the crime at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during tonight's show at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. In the early morning hours of Friday, July 20th, a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, erupted in chaos when a gunman unleashed a rain of terror and bullets during the premiere showing of the movie The Dark Knight Rises. The shooting spree left 12 people dead and another 58 injured. Joining me to discuss what is being referred to as the movie massacre is Dr. Scott Bond. Dr. Bond is a professor of criminology, media expert and analyst, public speaker and author. He's an expert on criminal behavior and the motivations of criminals. He offers insights into various types of crime, including white collar, state crime, bullying, domestic violence, sexual assault, and serial homicide. He's the author of Mass Deception, Moral Panic, and the U.S. War on Iraq, a critically acclaimed book on war crime and terrorism from Rutgers University Press. You can learn more about Dr. Bond by visiting his website at www.docbonn, that's docbonn.com. Professor, welcome back to Crime Wire.
Thank you, Denny. It's always good to be here.
This Aurora shooting case is absolutely, well, I don't know, every time we have one of these things, I always think it won't get any worse, and yet somebody seems to pull off something as bad or in some cases worse than the last one. So these people apparently are out there in abundance enough to get these things done. And when I'd just like to start out and see if you could give me some advice on something here, your opinion. I have heard some of the commentators talking about the shooting, call it a tragedy, and a couple of others call it an atrocity. Is either, did they both mean the same thing, or is one a better description than the other?
Well, it certainly is a tragedy and an atrocity, so I would say that it's both. And it certainly is one of the worst mass murders of all time, and the only one in recent memory that in fact is worse in terms of the number of people killed and injured was the Virginia Tech massacre of 2007, where 32 people were killed and 17 others were wounded in two separate attacks that same day on the Virginia Tech campus. But this one was certainly horrible. And we have 58 people injured in addition to the 12 who were tragically killed. And so, to answer your question, I would say that both of those apply, both in terms of tragedy as well as atrocity. And I wanted to distinguish, sometimes words are used interchangeably. Sometimes serial killers are referred to as mass murderers or spree killers. And would it be useful, do you think, to distinguish between those different terms?
Absolutely. Please do.
Okay. A mass murder is a one-time event where multiple people are killed, but it's in one specific event. And it usually takes place when an individual has oftentimes a psychotic break from reality. Oftentimes it's a very, very troubled individual who over time builds up resentments toward an alleged group of tormentors. And in this case, I believe it was society in general. I think that James Holmes was angry at society in general for not appreciating his genius, and we can talk more about that specifically. But I think it built up over time, and he snapped and committed this this event. Now, this is very typical of mass murder in terms of a premeditated event that where multiple lives are taken. What's a bit unusual, though, is that James Holmes was actually taken alive, because typically mass murderers are either shot by law enforcement at the scene of the crime, and frequently, as did the killer in the Virginia Tech murders, turn the gun on themselves, and their final act is actually suicide. So James Holmes is a little bit different than mass murders in that regard. Now, that's very, very different than serial homicide. Serial homicide is where a perpetrator killed multiple individuals, and there's some debate over whether the correct number should be at least two victims or three victims. I use the more rigorous number of three, where these individuals are killed in separate events, separate locations, where there's an emotional cooling off period between those murders. And that emotional cooling off period is the feature that really distinguishes serial homicide, because serial killers are driven by fantasy, and they're driven by urges to kill. And they will emerge from their seemingly normal life oftentimes to kill, and then once they've satisfied that hunger, that desire to kill, they will fade back into the woodwork for a certain amount of period of time, and they cool off, literally cool off emotionally, and blend back into, as I said, what oftentimes seems to be a normal life. And that is also distinguished from what are known as spree killings. And a spree killing is where you have multiple killings in separate events, but in a very, very short time frame, usually no more than a week. And the classic example of that, of course, was the D.C. murders of Malvo and Muhammad, the D.C. snipers a few years ago.
So what we have here, as far as we know then, is a mass murderer in the case of Mr. Holmes.
Yes,
because
definitely.
We don't know that he did any other events prior. So this was a mass murder, one event, when he had all his victims.
That's right. That's right. And it was premeditated, as most mass murders are. And what is really unusual, though, for mass murder, is that he organized this over months. He built up his ammo supply. He meticulously laid out the plans for this. He timed it specifically to be during the premiere of The Dark Knight Rises on July 20th. So this was meticulously planned. And that also distinguishes it from other mass murders, where sometimes an individual, as I said, will just snap and go on a shooting spree. And you may have heard the term going postal in the vernacular. People talk about going postal. Well, the reason that term even exists is back in the 80s, there were a number of well-documented cases where former disgruntled postal workers went back into their former workplaces and committed a mass murder. And that was done, it was premeditated, but it was rather spontaneous in that they were not planned over long periods of time. So yes, certainly Holmes is a mass murderer, but he was also a very meticulous and well-planned mass murderer.
Let me just run a question by you that came in from a friend of mine through Facebook. Given the overall circumstances, and one of the circumstances mentioned is how the Holmes apparently had booby-trapped his apartment that would kill the next person to enter into that building apartment. Is it possible that he intended to die that night, and then somewhere along during the commission of the act or something changed his mind? Because the person who asked the question said, based on the apartment and so forth, it looked like at one point he maybe never intended to return. So did he intend to go out in a blaze of glory, then backed out of it or something when he got to the theater?
That's a very good question, and the booby trap was certainly planned for the police. I mean, that is in my mind clearly who the target of the booby trap was, and I'm not convinced at all that he intended to go out in a blaze of glory. It would have been very easy for him to turn a gun on himself. It also would have been very easy for him to commit suicide by cop, meaning that present himself in an antagonistic way to the cops and allow himself to be shot. Apparently, and there's a little bit of confusion about this, but apparently he was very, very passive and turned himself in quite voluntarily when the police arrived. And there also seems to be some possibility or indication that the cops didn't really originally realize that he was the perpetrator, because he had body armor on, you know, like Batman, and the kind of body armor also that SWAT teams wear. And therefore, they initially quite possibly confused him as being one of them. And then they quickly realized that was not the case. And he then very passively turned himself in. But what he did say to them, the first words that he said is, "I am the Joker." And of course, referring to the villain from Batman fame.
And then, of course, he had the hair was colored too, I believe, or orange or red hair dye job and so forth.
Yeah, well, not just his hair. Apparently his entire body. He had painted his entire body red as well as dyed his hair red. So, and they had to wash him off, actually, when he was booked. And of course, his hair still remains orange, sort of orangey-red. I saw his appearance yesterday in court, and he still has that sort of Ronald McDonald hair.
he's, I believe, 24 years of age. He was... I haven't heard of anything in his background that he was in a lot of trouble, had a lot of issues. Have you heard anything about that? That he was a bad kid or something?
Not at all. Yeah, I mean, all indications are that he was quite brilliant. And you don't get into a doctoral program in neuroscience at the University of Colorado unless you are extremely intelligent. He was apparently quite unassuming, very almost shy. So, no, and I'm not aware of any criminal background, any criminal history. What we do know, however, and this has become very controversial just in the last couple of days, is that he had been under the psychiatric care of mental health director at the University of Colorado, a professional by the name of Lynn Fenton. She was the director of health services there, and he had been under her care. She's a specialist in schizophrenia, and he had been her patient apparently for some time. And so there is some controversy, actually not some, quite a bit of controversy over how much she knew, to what extent she was aware of his severe issues, severe mental problems. He apparently sent a package to her containing a notebook that laid out his plans and had drawings, stick figure drawings of a mass murder. They're not exactly sure when she received this, but the police confiscated it, seized it on the 23rd, so 3 days after the shootings. And I believe that Dr. Fenton is going to be under a tremendous amount of scrutiny about what she knew and when she knew it in regards to his mental health.
Professor, I want to get back to that in a minute, but we have a caller on the line. Let's see what our caller has to say for a question or comment. A caller from area code 702, go ahead.
Yes, hello, everyone. This is Manny Babalitza again, and this is a very sad case, and I think another blow to America in that we're wondering where we're going. And I have actually an observation and then a question, gentlemen. The observation is that I fear that the way this person committed this crime, this Joker aspect, you mentioned the Ronald McDonald, okay, is going to affect many of the younger people who seek to be the isolate, the social isolate. And, well, let me put it in less arrogantly and put it in the form of a question. Doctor, do you believe that the uniqueness of this crime, and of course the depth of it too, will affect some of our youth and heaven forfend, perhaps even produce a copycat kind of scenario?
Well, you know, the thing is, as extreme as this case is and as horrible as it is, I'm writing a book about serial killers right now, and while this is a mass murder, the sensational nature of it is very similar to a serial killer in terms of the publicity that it receives. And the thing is, I think in the mind of the public, this is almost interchangeable news and entertainment. The nature of this killing.
Yeah.
Is not that much different than The Dark Knight Rises, the movie itself, which is sort of this apocalyptic, horrific sort of scenario. And children are exposed just 24/7 to images of violence that are fictionalized violence as well as real violence. And I'm not so sure that this really adds anything to a picture that is already rather troubled and already extreme in terms of the nature of violence that children are exposed to. So the answer is the volume is already turned up so high that I'm not sure that this really adds anything unique to it. It's just another tragic example.
Well phrased. The only little asterisk I'd like to add to that is another question on this topic of the youth, the fact that he is living, right? Had he been shot, doctors you mentioned, it goes away faster. Now we're going to go through, I assume, a procedure that is going to carry 24 charges of murder, I assume, and he's going to be in the public eye as, again, a joker, although in prison garb, I assume. So do you think that he might be an exception to what you just said? He's not here's what I'm trying to say. I lived in Yonkers, the famous residence of Son of Sam, and he was your average Joe. What was this your average Joe? This is what I'm questioning, and therefore, if he wasn't this neuroscientist of the future, if he was not, if he was the anomaly, the isolate, the different one, might he again, because of the trial coming on, have a little more effect than some of the others?
Well, I guess we're going to find out. What's going to be really interesting in this case is whether he's even found competent to stand trial. There's already quite a bit of debate. Some of the the guards in the jail where he's being held believe that he's faking his amnesia. He's saying to them, "I don't know why I'm here. Why are you holding me? Why am I in this jail?" Some of them think he's faking it, and then there are other professionals looking on, psychiatric professionals, who believe that he truly is had a psychotic break. So the first thing that's really going to be determined in this case is whether he's even competent to stand trial. And if he's found not competent to stand trial, then he's going to be put into an institution for the criminally insane, and he'll sit there until such time that it's deemed that he's able to stand trial. And if one has a long memory in these sort of horrific crime cases, Ed Gein is a classic example of a gentleman who sat in a mental institution for a very long time until determined competent to stand trial. And so really, that's the first thing that we're going to be dealing with here.
I didn't realize that. I thought that even if the defense were a cognitive defense or a volitional insanity defense, I thought that the defendant had to be in court anyway.
If it's determined that he is not capable of understanding the charges against him, then he would not be competent to stand trial.
I see. So that it's all going to hinge on that. And I personally, you know, I want to see justice done, but I don't want to see him become a hero. So it's kind of a Scylla and Charybdis kind of thing where I just hope he doesn't wind up, and I'm sure you do too, in the spotlight. And I thank you for your astute answers, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you gentlemen, and I thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you very much.
Manny, appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Professor, there's a couple of things I want to talk about here with Manny's calling, we got into the insanity situation, the competency situation. It just happened that over the past week, I've been looking into a case in Central New York that involved the murder of a six-year-old girl. It was last year in 2011, and the was a live-in boyfriend who murdered this girl. And he was it was ruled that he was had a mental defect.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess part of the insanity defense. And the mother of the little girl is now attempting to get the laws changed in New York State. And one in particular, she wants to see the law regarding a verdict or an insanity or successful insanity or mental defect case, instead of saying not guilty by reason of insanity or mental defect, to say guilty with a mental defect. Supposedly, this would mean that if at some point this individual is, the individual will always be a guilty murderer, I guess that's the bottom line. And I don't really know where that goes. I understand the petition is getting a lot of signatures. I don't know if it'll end up anywhere. I was just curious, do you see any advantage to maybe make the people feel that there was more justice, if you will, at least having a guilty finding, even if the person doesn't go to prison?
Well, that would—I guess it would be very symbolic, wouldn't it? You know, that would be the—it would be more of a symbolic nature, so that the families felt that justice was due, regardless of the actual sentencing outcome. A case that comes to my mind—it's not exactly the same, but where you have a sort of a symbolic nature. The serial killer Dennis Rader, who called himself Bind, Torture, Kill, he was found guilty of 10 separate murders, and he was given 10 consecutive life sentences. Now, only a cat lives 9 lives, so he would have to outlive a cat to serve all of these. They're back to back. In other words, the 10 sentences are back to back. And I've had people ask me, well, why would they do that? Why would they give him 10 back to back life sentences? And there's really two reasons for it. One is very pragmatic and practical, that so that in the event that there's any technical issue with one of the charges or one of the crimes, and it would be overturned in some way, that he would still be incarcerated because he would have 9 more to back to back. That's one reason, and then the other is the symbolic aspect of it, so that all 10 families feel that they've each individually had justice served, and they're not just lumped together in one life sentence.
Yeah, and I can see we're trying to think of as one of the surviving family members where that might be important to know that your loved one's case got its own sentence and its own attention. Before we get back to the psychiatrist who was supposedly treating Mr. Holmes, we have another call. Let's take that first. Caller from 860, you're on the line. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Denny, this is Donna Gore, Lady Justice.
Hi, Donna, how are you?
I'm just fine, and hi, Doc Don, how are you?
I'm good, how are you doing?
Very well, and it's a pleasure to talk to you live and in person. I'm finding the show very interesting, and I just had a couple of things I wondered if you could possibly address. I'm wondering... For number one, with the advent of these very public displays of violence, do you see any move in the future to ratchet up the security in that maybe movie theaters will now have metal detectors, or when you go into the football stadiums, you're going to have extra security, or... does this kind of fade out after 2 or 3 months and everyone kind of goes back to their normal, whatever it is?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we certainly, what immediately comes to my mind is the increased security and the very ultra-conscious awareness of security that happened in this country after 9/11. So the potentiality is there. You know, I've already heard rumors that not specific numbers, but I've heard allegations that gun sales are on the increase in the United States, so people are stocking up on guns to protect themselves. And of course, politicians are already calling for a new ban on assault rifles. And of course, the NRA and a lot of conservative politicians are fighting against that. But there could certainly be a call for increased security in public places.
Well, I think the movie industry, by and large, except for these teenagers and young 20s, they're in trouble anyway with Netflix and being able to see everything on your computer. So I would think that they would kind of fight against that. They want to try to find things in which people will still come to the theater like they did in the old days. But the other question I had, and I don't know that I recall anyone ever addressing this, and kind of trying to put yourself in the shoes of the parents of Mr. Holmes. Now, I'm thinking of the killer of Annie Ray and Yale and Raymond Clark. Things like this that are so horrific, and you could tell that the families are just devastated. Has your research revealed that the parents of the perpetrator, is there any pattern? Do they typically become very reclusive? Do they somehow want to give back in some way? Or is there any kind of behavior pattern for the perpetrator's loved ones, if you will, or are they all individual?
Well, that's a great question, and certainly some incidents that come to my mind are like the parents of Jeffrey Dahmer, for example, who just have spent years and years trying to understand their role in his development. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great question because we always are concerned, and as we should be, about the families and the parents of the victims. But what about the parents of, as you said, of the perpetrator? Imagine what living hell that must be to realize
they're victims too, right? Right.
Yeah, exactly. And to think, how they may have been in some way culpable, or what might they have done differently in the terms of raising their child. That has to just be a nightmare. So, yes, I think that certainly our hearts have to go out to them as well. Now, and there's every indication that James Holmes came from a fine household, that he had a pretty normal upbringing. But of course, there are other situations where infamous killers and certain serial killers, for example, that come to my mind, who grew up in absolutely horrific, abusive situations, where their upbringing clearly was implicated into the individuals that they became. And I'm thinking of people like Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer, who was absolutely tortured by his mother and locked in a root cellar as a child, and grew up hating his mother. So there are those, other types of scenarios as well.
I see. Yeah, very interesting. Like I said, I was just wondering, and am I correct that typically, if he is diagnosed, well, he has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, that it may typically come on in the mid to the late 20s, and it kind of rears its ugly head, once they become in college or graduate school?
Yeah, he's the perfect age. He's absolutely the perfect age for it. And, since you brought up the question again, or the same issue, I wanted to elaborate for everyone listening that there's a couple different ways this can go. If he's found simply incompetent to stand trial, that he's deemed to be legally insane now and doesn't understand the charges against him, then he could be held indefinitely in an institution for the criminally insane, until at which time he is deemed to be competent to stand trial. That's one possible scenario. Yeah, on the other hand, if he's deemed to be competent now, then his defense team can use the not guilty by reason of insanity defense. But man, is that a high bar to clear. It's the most difficult defense to make, and what it does, it's the only defense where the burden of proof is on the defense to prove that their client was actually insane, legally insane, at the time of the murders. So the shift, the burden of proof shifts from the state to actually the defense when the not guilty by reason of insanity defense is used.
Is that based solely on psychiatric testimony?
Well, yes, that's where professionals would come in on both sides. If this case goes that route and that is the plea, not guilty by reason of insanity, then you are going to have mental health experts lining up on both sides, prosecution and defense, and they will be contradicting one another and trying to refute one another's testimony.
Right. Wow. Well, very interesting. Well, thank you so much for your comments. I'll sign off now and just be a regular listener. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the call.
Okay. Thanks,
Doctor.
Donna. Thank you, Denny. Talk to you later.
Okay. Good night, Donna. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Professor, I wanted, when we took our first call, we had been talking about the psychiatrist for Colorado University. And you mentioned that she's going to be under some intense scrutiny as to what she did, didn't do, or what she knew and when she knew it, and so forth.
Yeah.
I've heard different commentators on the news channels indicate that she would have had a duty to report if she had specific information. Now, at least that's the way my understanding of what these people have been saying. So that she not only would have had to say, oh, this guy, you know, looks to me like he could be dangerous. She would have had to have had something where she knew he was intended to go to a theater with X number of weapons and so forth and kill all the people he could kill. Is that your understanding, that that the information she had in order to trigger this duty to report had to be that specific, or would it just be suspicions?
Well, I don't believe, I'm not that intimately familiar with the law of the state of Colorado, but many states have a ruling or have a law that if a medical professional, if a healthcare professional like Dr. Fenton has reasonable suspicion that this individual will can be a danger to himself or herself or to others, and has evidence of that fact, then they have an obligation to make that known to authorities. And a doctor such as Dr. Fenton also has the ability to have homes taken into medical care, even against his will, can be hospitalized against his will for his own protection if she believes that he is a threat to himself or others. So there were a couple of different ways that she could have gone here, and she had that responsibility depending, once again, upon the evidence that she had at hand. And what's going to really be integral to this case and how this plays out, on August 16th, there's going to be a hearing where they're going to determine whether or not this notebook that was sent to her is considered privileged information between the doctor and patient. And she was going to have, she's going to be in a deposition. They're going to ask her under oath when she received it, and if it's determined that it is in fact admissible, and if she had this a couple of days, let's say, before this shooting, and it in fact shows pictures of you know, these stick figures in a movie theater being killed, then that would suggest to me that she had all the evidence that she needed to step forward and approach authorities.
So that's going to be a very interesting deposition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So she, this doctor, could really be at the heart of this case and what she knew and when she knew it. And she could actually be in some deep legal waters herself, depending upon how this plays out in court.
And another thing I've been hearing a lot about, and I'd like you to comment on, is the, especially initially, over the first couple of days after the shooting, there was a lot of talk about the planning, the premeditation, and this booby trapping the apartment, all this kind of thing. And some people were opining that the premeditation, the degree of planning that went into this this thing, would really make it very difficult for an insanity defense. Then other people have come on more recently, other so-called experts, and said, well, not necessarily true. There can be a lot of planning. You can still be crazy. Do you have any thoughts on that as to whether the premeditation helps or hinders or has no impact on the insanity piece of it?
Sure. And it's a very good question. From the standpoint of just logic and reasonability, the fact that he was so meticulous, so well planned in this, suggests that he was operating with it at least enough rationality that he knew what he was doing, that he was competent. That completely contradicts a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. That's at first blush. However,
yes,
the bar for sanity, the legal bar, is set so high that in order to be considered insane, one has to just not know that something was wrong, illegal, at the time that they did it. So in other words, the only way that James Holmes could be found not guilty by reason of insanity is if at the time that he was shooting up that theater, at the very moment that he was doing it, as he was pulling the trigger, he would have to not know that it's legally wrong to do that when he was doing it. Do you see how high that bar is? And there's very little likelihood that he would meet that standard. In other words, I believe, you know, as we talk this through, that if he uses the not guilty by reason of insanity defense, it's probably going to fail abysmally. He is not going to be successful with that defense because all of the evidence is contrary to it.
And let me ask you this now. We've been talking a little bit about the apartment and the booby trap, and it seems clear that, as you mentioned, that it was he wanted to kill a few cops if they went into that building. Now, let me say this to you, just as regarding the insanity defense that he didn't know right from wrong and so forth. Well, wouldn't the booby trap in the apartment show that he knew he was going to be in trouble, that the cops were going to be coming looking for him?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And the mere fact that he set those booby traps still doesn't indicate to me necessarily that he was fatalistic or wanted to die. What it suggests to me is really it's very paranoid. And in the event that he is detected and they find his lair, if you will, that he wanted to take out as many people as possible. What I really think, I mean, I'm going to give you, just based upon the evidence, based upon what we know right now, I'm going to suggest to you that this is an individual who had tremendous rage and revenge in mind. I think that's what his motivation was. We know that he voluntarily dropped out of this doctoral program, but he did so after his oral exams, in which he apparently did not do all that well. His work was on the decline at the University of Colorado. And what I believe happened was that he is probably an individual who is quite full of himself and his intellectual abilities. And when he was told that his work was just not cutting the mustard, so to speak, that he became very resentful. And how dare you suggest that my work isn't up to par? And probably very grandiose, and which is also very consistent with narcissism and paranoia. And I think he simply retaliated and took matters into his own hands and decided to send a message to the world that I'm going to show you. And what better place to do it than in a public place like a movie theater? And his selection of an apocalyptic vengeful type portrayal, like the Dark Knight Rises. I mean, it's all about vengeance. That's the the theme. It's the perfect metaphor. It's the perfect drama to play that out in. And then, of course, he picks the Joker, and the Joker, if you recall from the previous movie, The Dark Knight, in which Heath Ledger, the late, great Heath Ledger, played the Joker, what's one of his famous lines in that movie? "I am an agent of chaos," is what he told law enforcement. And I believe that James Holmes, that was his inspiration, the Joker, I truly believe that he thought he was an agent of chaos, and he was going to pay back society in the way he thought was appropriate.
Wow. So we agree, I think, and I don't think there's much dispute by anybody, that this was premeditated, whether it meant he was lucid or sane or not, I guess is up to the experts and so on. But and he certainly planned it very well, planned it apparently for months, seemed to have been quite efficient in his planning and actually carrying out the his mission. He was seemed to be on a mission that night. Now, there's been some talk, and you mentioned the increase in gun sales following this episode, and there have been some people that said, well, the problem is not too many guns, it was too few guns. Had a few of these people been armed that night in that theater, they could have taken him out, and this would have been a different story. I'm a Second Amendment guy, and I have several guns myself, okay? But I'm trying to think of, under the circumstances that night, I understand that he threw so much smoke bombs or something, and the visibility was a little tough. Some people thought the shots were maybe firecrackers going off, or they were part of the movie somehow, and there seemed to be a lot of confusion going on. I'm just wondering if you had untrained people. Now, I'm not talking about the Navy SEAL, for example, home on leave, sitting in the theater. But if you had just some regular Joes who happened to be carrying, I'm just wondering, what do you think? Do you think that would have been a help or a hindrance, and maybe it could have made it worse if a bunch of people started blazing away without really knowing what was happening?
I can only envision a smoke-filled theater with chaos. Just imagine the chaos that erupted in there. And you now have individuals not highly trained with guns. Imagine the crossfire and the possibility for real Armageddon inside that theater. I mean, it was bad enough as it was. I don't know that more guns would have made the situation any better. Plus, remember, he was wearing body armor also. So he was not exactly an easy target. But, the fact that gun sales, again, anecdotally, we've been told, we've read this, that gun sales are on the increase, doesn't surprise me at all. And just as one of the callers was asking about increased security and so forth, yes, there will be, I'm sure, calls in certain circles for increased security in public places. And that's just going to happen after a situation like this. It's natural. You know, we saw it, of course, after 9/11. But the reality is these things are going to continue. There's 300 million people in the United States, and there's something like 600 million guns collectively between legally registered guns and illegal guns. So guns are pretty easy to get. And there's plenty of them out there. And the reality is if an individual who wants to kill is going to find a way to kill. And we've seen it time and time again. And I don't believe that someone like this, someone like James Holmes, anything would have stopped him short of an intervention. You know, if he had been hospitalized, perhaps against his will, and if someone had intervened, you know, perhaps then. But short of that, nothing was going to stop this guy. He was determined. He was smart. He was meticulous. He was premeditated, and he was certain he was going to do it. I would go so far as to say that in some ways he's enjoying his newfound infamy, because I really believe that's a big part of this was. He selected his Joker persona for a reason. He selected that night and the premiere of the movie for a reason. He wanted recognition. This was part of his mission was public recognition.
Do you believe, or first, let me back up for a second. Let's talk about law enforcement. What was your impression as of now about how law enforcement handled this? We said that, I believe you mentioned earlier, that the first responders might have been a little confused initially about, you know, just who he was, but they did take him into custody. I thought, my opinion was they seemed to have done a good job. They got a lot of response there quickly. What do you think of the law enforcement response to the incident?
Again, looking at this from the outside, you know, I'm not there in Colorado, but following it very closely, it seems like they've done a terrific job. I mean, I can't imagine that they could have handled it any better. And he, you know, from his surrender there in the parking lot, apparently outside of the movie theater, from that moment forward, they seem to have handled it very well.
And what do you think of the media coverage? What do they call it, the fog of war, how you get different conflicting stories initially in one of these major events. But generally speaking, have you found the media to be a pretty good in their coverage of this?
Well, there's a tendency in these kind of cases. You see it in serial killer cases. You see it in mass murders. There's a tendency by the media, by the mainstream media, to reduce these individuals to literally one-dimensional cartoon characters. Now he in fact is calling himself a cartoon character, the Joker. But there's this tendency to reduce them to sort of a one-dimensional monster sort of image. And as a matter of fact, the two words that you typically see most often in stories related to him, as well as generally serial killers, are the words either evil or monster, and sometimes referred to both simultaneously. And I think that's by design, because it's so incomprehensible and it's so foreign to those of us who can't imagine doing such things. It's so beyond us to understand why someone would do such a thing that the media reduces them to these, sort of cartoonish, almost one-dimensional cutout characters. And it's easier to understand that, because if he's simply evil, then we don't have to understand anything else. We don't have to know anymore. We don't have to dig any deeper. Evil is evil. You see what I'm saying? So it makes it palatable. It makes it easy for the public to just sort of accept.
And let's assume for the moment that the insanity defense, if it's tried, is not successful, and that there is an actual trial. What do you think the chances are of him getting a fair trial there? And obviously, the whole state, I understand, is up in arms. Of course, they had Columbine, and now this guy, and. I don't know. There probably aren't too many people in the state of Colorado that aren't aware of what happened in Aurora.
Yeah, well, that's the risk that you run with any of these incredibly high-profile cases. In criminal justice circles, we call these kind of cases top-of-the-wedding-cake cases. And what I mean by that is, you know how a wedding cake is tiered so that it gets smaller and smaller, you know, each level until the top? Well, this would be at the top of that wedding cake, meaning that it receives all of the various treatments of the criminal justice system, all of the expert witnesses, plus the relentless 24/7 media coverage. So it's one of those very few cases that just captures the public imagination, like O.J., you know, the O.J. Simpson trial and Lacey Peterson, Scott Peterson's a murder of his wife, those kind of cases. And so is it possible to get a group of jurors who have heard nothing about this case and have been completely unaffected by the media? No, the answer is no, unless the person is deaf, blind, and living on the moon. How could you possibly not be exposed to this case? Now, having said that, you know, we still have a system based upon the value and the principle of innocent until proven guilty. So if we believe in our system, you have 12 jurors, and in this case, they may well have to be capital punishment-ready jurors, meaning that they're ready to allow him to be executed if found guilty. And that's simply the way our system works. So we have to, if we believe in our system, yeah, then we have to believe that ultimately justice will prevail. But that's a different question than whether or not people will be influenced by the media. Of course they will. There's just no even if they're sequestered, even if they would be sequestered during the trial, what about all of the pre-trial publicity? They can't possibly avoid what's happening right now.
Yeah, and I assume it's like a lot of these cases that, if this actually goes forward to a trial, that there will be probably some maybe requests for change of venue. But I don't really know, you know, anywhere in that state that they're going to find, like you say, somebody who has not been exposed to the case. It could be Manny back on here. Let's see. Hello, 702. Is that you, Manny?
Yes, Manny. I just wanted to tell both of you that many people called me since I was on, and they were asking about, again, this legal aspect. One thought that hit me was actually what my wife Sharon just asked me. I'm talking to you now, by the way, as I'm talking to you. And that is, Doctor, do you think that everything might hinge upon the psychiatrist? Because the neighbors, she tells me, seem to be saying, well, yeah, he looks fine. That if she was a psychiatrist who specialized in schizophrenia, did you say?
Yes, that is her specialty.
All right, so would that work to the advantage of an insanity plea?
Well, she would be, she's going to come into play in a couple of ways. Initially, before the determination is made to as to whether or not he is fit to stand trial, and if the defense tries to say, well, look, this is his own psychiatrist, and she says that he suffers from schizophrenia, well, the state, the prosecutors are going to bring in their own psychiatrists,
okay,
who are likely to say, no, he is very competent to stand trial. And let's just say that we make it over that first hurdle and he is found competent to stand trial. Once the trial begins, they're still going to have to go through it once again, whether or not he meets the bar of not guilty by reason of insanity. So this is going to play out in a couple of waves, actually, the mental health issue.
That's fascinating, because I didn't realize, and my wife and some other people who called, that it's not all going to depend upon the psychiatrist, who she might say, well, of course, he's seen me because I thought he was schizophrenic, et cetera. The state would then, as you just enlightened us, bring in their psychiatrist to say, no, this guy could have been going to you, et cetera. He's a very, very, very bright person.
That's right. They would attempt to refute it, and that's what happens during the this period here. This is gonna take a while. To the extent that it does go to trial, we've got a long time ahead of us before we even reach that point. And if it does go to trial, you're looking at a long drawn out process here. And to your point, Manny, this guy is going to be in the public eye. He's going to be in the public eye for some time to come.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. But at least, as you say, we have to trust this judicial system, and we're kind of calloused, thinking, you know, it's failed in the past. But as you say, it's all we have. And I'm very glad I was able to get back to you so that people now know that even if the psychiatrist does claim that he is mentally ill, that the state can bring in its arsenal also.
So
again, I thank you.
Thanks, Manny.
Okay.
Thank you, Manny. Gentlemen, Professor, listen, I don't know where the time went to. It's been a fascinating hour, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much again for being with us tonight and sharing your insights.
Well, it's my pleasure, and as always, Denny, and also I just want to say that I will be posting a blog also tomorrow about our conversations tonight and some more thoughts about this case on my website, www.docbond.com, tomorrow, if anyone would like to read more about it.
Well, I certainly will, so I'll be checking it out, Professor. Thank you very much to the Crime Wire team, Director of Research Kim Colton, Public Relations team, and ImagineFublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, August 7th, when we'll talk about the eConnect scandal, a large fraudulent security scheme. Our guests will be an eConnect insider who managed to avoid going to prison, and one of the scam's victims, and pleased to say that Professor Bond will be joining us for that too, because he is also an expert in white-collar crime. So I'm looking forward to talking with you again next week, Professor.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it as well.
Okay, have a great night. And remember, we ensure your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website, www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.